Welcome to Chapels from Rosedale Bible College. Thanks for joining our community for weekly chapels recorded on our campus in Rosedale, Ohio. We hope you are challenged and inspired by what you hear. Enjoy.
So we're going to look at Luke chapter 16 this morning. The parable of, as it's called in my Bible, the dishonest manager, sometimes the unjust steward. This is probably one of the more enigmatic parables that Jesus told, although all of them have some element of enigma, I suppose. It's interesting to me that the superficial reading of this parable suggests that Jesus is actually affirming dishonesty. This is the view that Julian the Apostate, the last pagan Roman ruler in the 4th century, he claimed that Jesus taught his followers to be liars and thieves. So Romans, you should not be Christians. I think he misinterpreted the parable. Others say Jesus is speaking ironically here, like there's a twist, because clearly you can't buy your way into heavenly dwellings, so maybe Jesus isn't being quite, you know, straightforward. There's a twist here. The fellow who ought to know better, Spiros Zodiates, he inverts the common reading of this parable and says, aha, the steward is great. This is really a parable about the unjust owner. That, the steward realized that his situation was changing and he adapted, so he's good. It's the owner who's bad. Kenneth Bailey, in his book, we have this in the library, I recommend it, Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes, he tries to think about this parable in terms of how it might have landed to the original hearers, and he suggests that we have a problem in the English, well, in our modern Bibles, because we so easily adapt to the fact that there's a chapter break between the parable of the lost son and this parable, because, indeed, chapter 16 begins with this parable, chapter 15 ends with the other parable, and he says they're really talking about the same thing. As you might note from the beginning of this parable where it says, he also said, to his disciples. So there's something to think about. It's clear, though, that this parable has something to do with money. So I think I'll make a few comments about Jesus' comments about money. How much does Jesus mention money? So from an article in that publication, Preaching Today, we find 16 of the 38 parables, or 11 of the 39, depends how you're counting, 16 of 38 were concerned with how to handle money and possessions. In the Gospels, an amazing 1 out of 10 verses, that would be 288 in all, deal directly with the subject of money. Also, it's pointed out that talking about money comes second after the kingdom of God. So by some counts, there's a total of 2,000 plus verses in both Testaments that talk about money, and love is only mentioned in 300 verses. So 2,300. So clearly, money is six times more important than love, yes? Well, it seems important to observe that Jesus mentioning money is, you know, this happens with some frequency. He doesn't devote very many occasions to saying, now here's how you should handle money, like he does with love. But money is there. So here we are. This parable is one of those, and I'm going to read it for you. He also said to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager. And the manager said to himself, what shall I do since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I've decided what to do so that when I'm removed from management, people may receive me into their houses. So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, "How much do you owe my master?" He said, 100 measures of oil." He said to him, "Take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Then he said to another, "And how much do you owe?" He said, 100 measures of wheat." He said to him, "Take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. One who is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much, and one who is dishonest in very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." So it's often been observed that parables often have like a tripartite structure. Like that word tripartite basically means they've got three characters here. And I think this is a case in point. We have the rich man, or sometimes he's described as the owner, who might be a good referent, seems to be maybe God, or maybe some people like Zodiates think not so much. What can we know about him? He's probably absentee. He's not really there at the place. He's apparently a good man, or people wouldn't have bothered to tattle on the manager. I mean, if he's gone and someone bothers to say, "Hey, sir, your manager is squandering your wealth," they must care a little bit about the owner. So the thought here is maybe he's a good man. Second character clearly is the steward or manager. Some people think he's the hero. Some people think he's, you know, the bad guy. Bailey here points out that his silence when he's accused, the master says, "What is this that you've done?" The steward does not defend himself. He doesn't say anything. Bailey calls this stunning. Like, what in the world? This guy must realize he can't play his master. He's not offering one word of defense or denial. He's just like, So he's apparently somewhat in awe of the owner. And then we've got these debtors, or some people call them the community. Why are they here? They don't say anything, but they do. They do participate in this plan that the steward comes up with. But if we look more closely into this parable, if we start with verse 1, what we see again here is the introduction of two main characters. These charges are informal. He had heard. These were hearsay charges, but apparently the owner believes them because he dismisses the master. And this word wasting is somewhat dramatic, I'm told, and suggests that he's like scattering the master's wealth. It's like it's disappearing. He's spreading it around. And the owner asks the steward what he's done, but we're not told about his response, so he's gone. Verse 3 is interesting. The manager says to himself, "What shall I do since my master is taking the management away from me?" And as he thinks ahead, he thinks, "Well, I could dig, but this digging could be like working the soil, or it could be like digging ditches, excavating, if you will." But it wasn't considered dignified, with apologies to our good friend Shad Greenwell. Steward didn't want to do that. And of course, begging really would have lowered his status or his sense of self-worth or his standing in the community. And it probably would have sent him back to the same people. He lived in this community, and now he was the steward, and then he would have just been a beggar. He really doesn't want to do either of those things. So he has a plan, and it seems like it comes to him suddenly, I know what I'll do. And so the question is, what exactly did he do? I mean, we're told what measures he took, but what is that? What was going on? So people, here's the enigma. Some people think he simply lowered the price, as it would appear from first reading. Or what do you owe? This much? Oh, just say this much. Some people say, clearly that's what's going on. Some people think, well, no, he wouldn't have done that. He's already caught. So maybe he's just removing the interest, which maybe shouldn't have been charged anyway. Or some people think, he must just be removing his commission. This is probably about the amount of his commission. You know, I don't know. Some people want him to be honest and a hero, so they say probably one of the latter two. Others are like, he's a scumbag. It must be the first one. It's also interesting that in the first case, he reduces the debt by 50 measures of oil. And in the second case, he reduces it by 20 measures of wheat. I don't know any of this from personal knowledge, but apparently wheat is considered more valuable than the oil. And so maybe it's about the same value that the debt is reduced. What does seem clear is that these debtors were people of means. Like, this was not small change. So to produce 50 or 100 measures of oil, they think maybe this person produced maybe 875 gallons of olive oil. That's quite a few trees worth, I think. And the wheat, to have had that many measures of wheat would take maybe 100 acres in the way that we measure. So these are not like small holders. These are significant farmers. 100 acres isn't much to us, but it would have been quite a bit in those days. And why is the steward here called dishonest? Some people say, well, clearly this is going back to verse 1 where he's wasting the master's wealth, so it couldn't be talking about what happened here. I don't know. Bailey, again, says, the scheme is exquisite. In the hour or two before the books are surrendered, while no one but the steward and the master know he's been fired, he calls in the largest debtors, who are actually business associates of his master, and has them record changes, thus involving them in theft, while leaving them with public deniability, since these interviews are all private. Sit down quickly. Change the number. So this is where Julian says, well, if Jesus affirmed this guy, you know, he's approving lying and cheating. But it's been pointed out that there is all the difference in the world between I applaud the dishonest steward because he acted cleverly, and I applaud the clever steward because he acted dishonestly. Jesus does not applaud the dishonesty of the steward. He applauds the cleverness. So the parable itself probably ends after the first part of verse 8. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. And then Jesus continues on to make comments. In verse 9, I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. This is the ESV, and it is translating here by the word or the phrase unrighteous wealth. That's translating what in the Greek is mammon. And what's interesting about mammon is not only is it sort of a complex idea of wealth itself and then of the deceptiveness of wealth, it's also interesting to me that this is a word that is basically brought forward from the Aramaic. In the Greek New Testament, they don't actually translate it. They just bring it in. So they use different characters, so we call that transliteration. But yeah, some people think it's an Aramaic word, and then it has, you can follow it back to Hebrew. Some references even say all the way back to Chaldee. This is an ancient word that they just keep bringing it forward into the language. So there's something about this word that makes it untranslatable, I guess. I like to say it has a certain je ne sais quoi. You can't translate that. Or if we think another context where we bring in words from other languages because they just capture things, we might say chutzpah from the Yiddish. Or in my extended family, people would sometimes revert to Pennsylvania Dutch because they're like, it's not the same thing in English. So mammon, this idea of mammon, unrighteous wealth. Also, it can be translated as worldly wealth, sometimes the riches of iniquity, or sometimes money. That one maybe strikes a little closer home. And it's personified. Here, you cannot serve God and mammon, actually, or money, or all these other possibilities. So what is the point of this parable? I said it was enigmatic, so people have lots of different ideas. Robertson says the purpose is that those who have been blessed and helped by money may give a welcome to their benefactors when they reach heaven. So as I understand Robertson, he's saying you give the money, and then people will change their lives, and you can welcome them into heaven because you've shared your things with them. And he adds, there is no thought here of purchasing an entrance into heaven by the use of money. Julian. Greg Keener thinks the steward was making the master look like a generous benefactor. And thus, what he was actually doing was staking his future on this master being afraid to punish him and so spoil the effects. Like the debtors might have thought, well, you know, this steward is just being generous on the master's behalf. And the steward is thinking, he won't want to change that impression, so he's going to just let things go. And then he says the moral of the story is, use possessions to serve people because you are only God's managers of anything that you have. Another possibility. Lawrence Richards points out the Pharisees had turned life upside down. They used people to gain things. Now Jesus sets the values straight and pointed to the worth of individuals to a loving God. Jesus showed that the servant of God the Father must use things, money, mammon, to gain the good of men and women. This is also possible. Warren Wiersbe made three applications. I won't spend much time with them, but he says basically we must invest our money in making friends for the Lord, which if you read further, I mean, this is essentially gospel witness. As Amy Carmichael pointed out, you can't pitchfork souls into heaven. They're more or less securely attached to bodies. So you have to help people to get them to hear. Kenneth Bailey, again, Jesus through Middle Eastern eyes, says Jesus calls the steward a son of this age, which is really a condemnation of him. Jesus calls the steward a son of this age and wants the sons of light to use their intelligence, like the steward, to trust completely in the mercy of God for their salvation. And then he says, see, this is the message of the lost son parable, and it is also the message of this parable. Bailey also says, if we read this parable, we should think about that God, like the owner in this parable, is correctly perceived as a person of mercy. We are astute when we understand that God is merciful. And he points out that despite this commendation of his shrewdness, the steward's sin is exposed. He doesn't get away with it. And he is called
a son of this age.
And once he's caught, you would hope that this steward would repent and change his ways. He doesn't say anything, no indication of repentance. And in fact, it's by at least some interpretations, he sins and squanders his master's wealth even more boldly than he did before. So here I hear that echo from prison. Sin will hold you longer than you want to be there, and it'll take you further than you want to go. Still true. So in sum, what is the purpose? What is the meaning of this parable? I offer three ideas. It is astute or savvy or shrewd to recognize that people matter more than money. That is easily heard as sort of a flippant thing to say, but this is really, really significant. People matter more than money. Secondly, true riches are spiritual. They are yours truly. Worldly wealth, it competes for our loyalty, but it is not ultimately ours because everything that we have belongs to God, and we can't take it with us. So mammon competes for our loyalty. It doesn't even really belong to us. It's false security. It's false happiness. And as Jesus says in verse 13, we cannot serve two masters. We'll love the one or hate the other. We cannot be followers of Jesus and followers of mammon. It just doesn't work that way. You should read this parable again. You should think about what its message means for you in your life. I'm not going to try to help you understand that, but I am going to pray for you before I sit down. Would you join me? Father, thank you that you are a person of great mercy.
Thanks for listening. If you found this episode helpful, please share so others can benefit from it as well. And be sure to check out our other podcasts at rosedale.edu/podcasts.